Tommy Forrester is dead. Tommy was going to be an engineer. He was 22, good-looking, personable, athletic. He had a high IQ. The dean said he had the best potential of any man in his class. But Tommy is dead. His problem was acid, lysergic acid formula 25 called LSD. A close friend told him LSD was psychedelic, mind-expanding. Said it would give him fantastic new sensations and thrills. So Tommy tried it, and his friend was right. At first, the LSD made him sick at his stomach, but then Tommy began to hallucinate. The air began to be filled with rainbows. The very atmosphere seemed to be a moving current of multicolored particles which came streaming down around him. When he listened to the stereo, he saw colored particles floating out from the speakers. When he looked at the walls, they seemed to be melting. The pictures on the walls became liquefied with colors running down like waterfalls. It was sensational. Inside himself, Tommy felt sublimated, sort of suspended in space. He had a euphoric feeling of wonderful well-being. Then he looked in a mirror, and something horrible happened. First, it seemed that half of his face was rotting away. Then he began to see himself as a grotesque, misshapen monster. He looked around the room and all the people were becoming monsters. Everybody knew what was happening to Tommy because he began screaming and describing what he was seeing. Tommy had the feeling he wanted to smash his head against the wall to bring himself out of this stupor. He did it. Blood spurted from his nose and a large cut bloodied his forehead. But he felt no pain. Then he pounded his head on a doorpost. Somebody in the room tried to stop him. He felt they were his enemy, so he jerked away. He ran into the next room where an open window looked out on a roof across the street. It was 18 stories to the ground. Tommy thought to himself that the roof across the street was really just a few inches away. He could jump on it and thereby escape. He tried it. Tommy is dead. Not everyone who tries LSD for the first time gets such a violent reaction. One authority estimates that among first-time users, about 1 out of 20 will go into a traumatic nightmare such as Tommy's. As for the other 19, their reactions are unpredictable, but will range all across the emotional spectrum. For some, it will be a scintillating and exhilarating ecstasy. For others, it will be repose, even stupefying. The cult of LSD users call any of these psychedelic experiences good trips if they don't end up out of control. But they never know when a bad trip will hit them. Just about the time a user begins boasting that he has become a real acid head and suffered no real ill effects, a bad trip can sweep him into emotional oblivion. A bad trip can send him wandering down the highway seeking to merge himself with some speeding automobile. It can send him into epileptic fits, make him schizophrenic, or permanently impair his sanity. It may rob him of the will to live and terminate in suicide. Others lose a sense of identity and cannot tell where the boundaries of their own bodies separate them from their environment. With some, there is a feeling of deep despondency and an accompanying fear that is wrong for them to go on existing. Even on so-called good trips, the acid user often becomes a serious hazard to himself. His whole sense of reality becomes distorted. He thinks he can fly like a bird or walk on water. He can look at a crack in the sidewalk and shrink back as though it were a Grand Canyon. Or he can look down from the top of a skyscraper and have the feeling it is barely inches to the ground. Scientists suspect that the LSD has its greatest impact on that part of the brain which decodes and interprets sensory impulses. By paralyzing or scrambling these sensory signals, the patterns in the brain become flamboyant, twisted, unreal. Sometimes the user thinks he can smell or taste the sound of music, or, as was the case with Tommy, he thinks he can see the music. The capacity of the brain to associate the present with the past is impaired. Perfectly familiar objects may seem completely foreign or non-identifiable. At the same time, the most bizarre associations seem to cloud the conscious mind, so that a user can be looking at a person and suddenly gain the impression that that person is dissolving away or turning into some kind of a strange monster. As with all psychedelic compounds, LSD not only diminishes the instinct of self-protection and self-preservation, but it removes the natural inhibitions. A professor of a Philadelphia university came out of his LSD spree to discover that he had been running naked and bleeding up and down the boulevard on which he lived. A prominent official of the government was found naked and freezing in the topmost branches of a backyard tree. From the point of view of the police, the problem of psychedelic drugs is not only what it can do to the user, but what a temporarily demented user often does to other people. During January of this year, four teenagers on a binge of LSD rammed into a house, killing a 3-year-old child. The police found the driver of the car to be in a psychedelic trance. After placing him in a jail cell, this teenager tried to climb the wall, shouting, "I'm a graham cracker. See, my arm just crumbled off." A woman in California who prided herself in being able to take LSD without any ill effects took a knife and slashed out the eyes of her child. A 30-year-old medical student who was recently apprehended for murder admitted that he had been under hallucination drugs for several days. His dazed brain was puzzled by the presence of police officers. He looked at them and said, "What have I done? Raped someone?" He had actually killed his own mother. All I have said so far about LSD is really an introduction to this recently developed acid cult compound. Nevertheless, I hope it will help you appreciate why some doctors have referred to this as one of the instant insanity drugs. LSD was not developed in the United States. It was discovered in 1938 by Dr. Albert Hofmann of the Sandoz Chemical Laboratories in Switzerland. Dr. Hofmann was doing special research with a purple fungus often found attacking rye plants. This fungus contained lysergic acid, which Dr. Hofmann was processing in a variety of ways to see if he could find something to tone up the nervous system. One of the formulas he compounded was designated as number 25. It was not until 5 years later that Dr. Hofmann discovered that his formula 25 was a psychedelic drug. While working with it, he accidentally inhaled some of the fumes. Within a short time, he began to hallucinate. He wrote that for 2 hours he had fantastic visions of extraordinary vividness, accompanied by a kaleidoscopic display of intense coloration. This formula was immediately patented by the Sandoz Corporation, which thereby became the only legal outlet for LSD-25 in all the world. In 1949, Max Rinkel of the Massachusetts Mental Health Center introduced this drug into the United States for experimental purposes. Small doses were administered in carefully supervised situations to see if a sense of well-being or euphoria could be artificially transmitted to alcoholics in certain types of mental cases. However, it soon became apparent that LSD-25 was a highly dangerous drug. Its side effects were totally unpredictable. When used on borderline mental cases, the LSD would sometimes send patients into a prolonged psychosis requiring extended confinement in a mental institution. A pattern of suicidal tendency also appeared among patients, and others suffered from severe schizophrenia or split personalities. Worst of all, it was discovered that LSD-25 has a delayed or residual reaction which can be neither anticipated or prevented. As Dr. Duke Fisher of the UCLA Neuropsychiatric Institute has written, quote, "It is possible to have recurrent LSD experiences without using the drug again. We have encountered many people who have given up LSD, only to find that as much as 2 years later, they are having paranoid feelings and hallucinations without taking LSD again. Unquote. Over 2,000 medical reports were written on the various aspects of LSD-25, and there was so much adverse publicity concerning it that the Sandoz laboratories took it off the market. However, it was known that this compound was not difficult to produce, so it was not long before the formula developed by Dr. Hoffman was being clandestinely passed along the corridors of certain university chemistry labs. It also began to come into the country from bootleg sources in Europe. Of course, a normal dose of LSD is so potent and microscopically small that it is easily concealed. Because it is colorless as well as tasteless and odorless, it is extremely difficult to detect, especially in a liquid solution. In powder form, the normal dose of 100 micrograms is so tiny it can hardly be seen by the naked eye. In a single ounce, there are approximately 280,000 doses. This means at the going rate of $5 per dose, an ounce of LSD-25 would be worth approximately $1,400,000. In liquid form, LSD has appeared in small ampules right on up to large bottles labeled mouthwash. Sometimes it may be found in crystalline form and packaged in capsules, or it may come as bulk powder and in the form of tablets. The latter are usually dissolved in a sweet liquid or in water and ingested. Or the liquid may be soaked into a cube of sugar, an animal cracker, or a candy wafer. It has even been found in chewing gum and the gummed flaps of envelopes. A common cigarette can conceal $50,000 worth of LSD, or 10,000 doses. As we have already mentioned, this particular drug was first introduced into the United States for medical research. However, by 1963, significant quantities of LSD were being bootlegged on certain university campuses. Its promoters described it as a genuine thrill potion, something real groovy. In fact, it was in 1963 that two professors were discharged from Harvard University for the alleged promotion of LSD among students. They were Mr. Timothy Leary and Dr. Richard Alpert. For several years, Dr. Leary had been experimenting with exotic mushrooms from Mexico, and when LSD came along, he boasted of becoming a regular user of it. He subsequently involved Dr. Alpert, and they were both discharged after it was allegedly determined that they had involved a considerable number of students in an institutionalized acid cult. After their discharge, Dr. Leary and Dr. Alpert set up an outfit called the International Federation for Internal Freedom. For a while, they operated in Mexico, but they attracted so much undesirable attention, the Mexican government became alarmed and asked them to leave. They thereupon returned to New York, where Dr. Leary procured a 64-room mansion in Millbrook, New York, which resembled a Bavarian castle. There, they set up a cultist colony called the Castalia Foundation. In December 1965, Dr. Leary was arrested at Laredo, Texas, for the illegal transportation of marijuana from Mexico to the United States. He was subsequently convicted and sentenced to 30 years imprisonment. However, the wheels of judicial appeal grind slowly, so Dr. Timothy Leary has remained at large on bond and has been enjoying unprecedented success in promoting his formula for a psychedelic adventure in acid ecstasy. In October 1966, a federal statute went into effect making it a federal crime to manufacture or possess LSD and certain other prohibited drugs. However, the Supreme Court then ruled that the use of peyote as a psychedelic drug in the religious ceremonies of certain Indian tribes is a constitutional right which cannot be denied them. As one might have expected, Dr. Leary soon organized his own tribal religion, using LSD, peyote, and marijuana as part of the sacramental ritual. He called his new religion the League of Spiritual Discovery. According to an article in the New York Times of September 20, 1966, Dr. Leary was demanding that the courts treat him at least as well as the Indians and allow his followers to legally consume these so-called sacred drugs of LSD, peyote, and marijuana in the private shrines of their own homes. Dr. Leary states that the goal of his new religion is to turn on, tune in, and drop out. That's a quote. He describes dropout as meaning, quote, to detach yourself harmoniously, tenderly, and gracefully from world commitments until your entire life is dedicated to worship and search, unquote. Medical authorities point out that what an acid user really does is to degenerate gradually into a mental vegetable, without ambition, without goals, and without the will to struggle. Gradually, the user withdraws more and more from social contact as the inner core of his entire personality seems to wither away. Among young people, Dr. Leary continually pushes LSD as an esoteric stimulant. He says, quote, an LSD session that doesn't involve an ultimate merging with a person of the opposite sex isn't really complete. One of the great purposes of an LSD session is sexual union, unquote. Of course, Dr. Leary knows that this acid compound is actually a sex depressant. But why should a super salesman of his national stature be concerned with such minor details? To protect himself, he always suggests that if young people don't happen to receive the promised endowment of esoteric stimulation from LSD, it may be due to the fact that they were distracted by all the rainbows and vivid colorations during the hallucination period. All authorities agree that strange mentalities like Timothy Leary and other advocates of acid ingestion are having an amazing success in converting more and more teenagers to try psychedelic drugs. Among students on a number of university campuses and sometimes even in high schools or junior high schools, taking a psychedelic trip has escalated into a status symbol. The health officer at the University of California, who is a physician, estimates that one of every four students on that campus has experimented with psychedelic drugs in one form or other. Four high school students in New York went on a psychedelic binge, and one of the girls describes her experience. She says, quote, I was looking at my friend Linda. Suddenly feathers popped out on her skin. Her nose curved into a beak. She had an eagle's face. I looked at my boyfriend Johnny. He was turning into a bird too. So was Linda's boyfriend. We were in Central Park Zoo. I couldn't move. I wanted to cry, but no tears would come. Oh, God, I heard myself yell. People really are animals. I started laughing hysterically, only inside I didn't feel funny. I started to run away from the others through Central Park until I stopped under a stone bridge. Johnny kept calling me. After a long time, I went up on the bridge. Johnny always had been my source of security. He said LSD was groovy and wouldn't hurt me. He said I'd see beautiful colors and hear musical notes, but I never did. Instead, I saw awful things. People looked like monkeys. Cracks in sidewalks became deep crevices you could fall into. Finally, after about 8 hours, the drug started to wear off. I was depressed for days afterwards. I never want to try that again, unquote. Actually, this girl was lucky. She came out of it. In a 3-month survey by the Los Angeles County General Hospital, it was found that 66% of the LSD patients brought into the clinic after a bad trip had to be classified as extended psychosis patients, meaning that they required immediate commitment to a state mental institution for prolonged treatment. One of the most recent discoveries of the respected geneticist Dr. Maimon M. Cohen is the fact that LSD not only damages the brain of the user, but it affects the human chromosomes, thereby leading to mental retardation and physical abnormalities in the offspring of LSD users. It has also been recently revealed that ever since 1955, the United States military service has been looking upon LSD as a chemical warfare bullet. They have pointed out that a single ounce of this concoction properly distributed can mentally unbalance approximately 300,000 people for a significant period of time. A few pounds of LSD dumped into the water supply of a major city would be enough to neutralize and disorient millions. This is why it has been looked upon as a chemical warfare weapon. Some 10 years ago, LSD was experimentally administered to certain military personnel without their knowledge. It was found that these troops soon ceased to function as a military force. Their discipline disintegrated into complete confusion. They were unable to respond to the most simple commands, and they could not perform the most routine tasks with any acceptable degree of accuracy. As an enemy sabotage weapon, here is the effect which it could have on a city, according to Dr. Sidney Cohen. chief psychosomatic officer of medicine at the Los Angeles Veterans Hospital. He describes it in his book entitled The Beyond Within and writes, quote, "The city exposed to a successful LSD attack presumably will cease to function. The inhabitants will be so bemused with the odd things that are happening to them and their neighbors that for half a day an aggressor force could take over without substantial resistance. A saboteur could carry enough in an overcoat pocket to produce serious temporary effects on all of the inhabitants of a megalopolis such as Los Angeles or New York, if only he could distribute it evenly. The contents of a two-suiter piece of luggage will hold amounts sufficient to disable every person in the United States." Unquote. The ease with which this brain-muddling chemical could be delivered to a whole population is contained in a recent report from Los Angeles, which says, quote, "Not only could it be distributed through the water supply, but it may be suspended in the air, and the inhalation is equally effective as a casualty producer." Unquote. At the present time, however, America's chemical warfare attack is not by enemies from abroad, but by enemies within. The Los Angeles Police Department reports that interviews with several thousand drug users clearly demonstrates that both young people and adults tend to follow a definite pattern of evolution as they commence with routine thrill pills and then progress gradually into heavy addiction with opiate narcotics. The Los Angeles report indicates that many young people are first exposed to neurostimulating drugs by pressure from their immediate friends and associates. The first step is to get high on some form of medicated drugs available at the corner drugstore. They discover that anything which can be used can be abused, and they set about to discover what strange sensations might emerge from overdoses of common medicines. The favorites are referred to as goofballs. The drug industry classifies these particular compounds as either amphetamines or barbiturates. The amphetamines are commonly called pep pills because of their capacity to stimulate the central nervous system. The barbiturates are depressants and are used as tranquilizers and sleeping pills. To safely facilitate the distribution of these drugs for the medical profession, they are put out in 12 different colors. Let's take a look at the amphetamines or pep pills first. The ingredients in these pills or capsules are usually benzedrine or dexedrine. They generally appear as white tablets which are scored on one side to facilitate breaking, or they may be a heart-shaped tablet with a salmon or sand color. When these pills are taken under the direction of a doctor, the prognosis of the patient is already known, and the right amount can be prescribed. However, in the hands of a layman, an overdose of these pills will produce extreme nervousness, marked insomnia, or inability to sleep, and in some cases, highly disturbing hallucinations. Now let us consider the tranquilizers and sleeping pills. These are the barbiturates, which have an opposite effect from the amphetamines. Those most commonly used are known as Nembutal, Secanol, Phenobarbital, Amitol, Barbital, and Iprol. Of course, their medical use is to help the patient relax and to induce sleep. What many people do not realize, however, is the fact that these drugs are addictive, habit-forming, so that the system can become critically dependent upon them. A person suffering from barbiturate addiction may be easily mistaken for a drunk. Here are the symptoms: slow, confused thinking, slurred speech, illogical and defective reasoning, obvious emotional disturbances, lack of coordination in walking and driving, tremors in the hands, oscillation of the eyes, and inability to hold them in a fixed position. As the toxic effect of barbiturates takes hold, the brain approaches semi-consciousness. In this condition, a person may inadvertently consume an additional quantity of the pills without knowing it. Such cases are sometimes mistaken for suicide attempts when no such intention actually existed. More people die each year from lethal doses of barbiturates than from any other kind of poison. It can be an extremely dangerous drug. Now, what happens if a person deliberately or accidentally consumes a heavy dose of pep pills and sleeping pills at the same time? Drug addicts call this a speedball. Three things happen under these conditions. First, the pep pills stimulate the central nervous system. Secondly, the barbiturates try to tranquilize the nervous system. Thirdly, the natural defenses of the body try to resist both chemicals in order to remain normal. All of this can result in the creation of a human zombie whose behavior may be completely erratic for several hours. The Los Angeles Police Department discovered that after individuals have more or less fooled around with the abuse of medical drugs, they tend to develop a curiosity to experiment with something a little more daring. Once again, it is not a professional pusher who usually gets a person to try something new, but the closest associates and friends. This next step is nearly always in the direction of the hallucination drugs. The most popular ones at the moment are LSD and marijuana. We have already discussed the effects of the more powerful LSD, so let us look briefly at marijuana. Marijuana is one of the oldest psychedelic plants in the world. It originated in China, but was later cultivated in India and became known as Indian hemp. The plant has a male and female species. The narcotic resin is particularly abundant in the female plant. Marijuana is processed by taking the flowering tops and leaves of both the male and female plants and then drying them by indirect heat. After the seeds and stems are removed, the dry fibers tend to crumble and resemble catnip or tea, hence the nickname for marijuana. Although there are several ways of using marijuana, the most popular method in the United States is smoking it. The marijuana cigarette is shorter and thinner than the commercial variety, and the ends are crimped and tucked in to prevent the contents from spilling out. Because these cigarettes pass through many hands as they are sold and traded back and forth, they are usually wrapped in double tissues of white or brown cigarette paper so as to stand the wear and tear. The effect produced by marijuana is that of excitement, sometimes hallucinations. However, increased indulgence will produce drowsiness and unconsciousness, so it is technically classified as a sedative. The pupil of the eye of the marijuana smoker becomes extremely dilated, and the white portion of the eye becomes bloodshot. In this condition, the pupil of the eye will not react normally to light, and the user will squint or completely close his eyes as though he were looking at the headlights of an approaching car. This is why the marijuana smoker often resorts to dark glasses and wears them even at night. This does not suggest, however, that everybody who happens to be wearing dark glasses is suffering from the toxic effect of marijuana. As with LSD, marijuana impairs time and depth perception. A curb may look like a deep canyon or cliff, but when the user is standing on a real cliff, he will swear that the bottom of the canyon is only a step away. Marijuana also destroys the normal inhibitions of the user, resulting in sexual promiscuity or criminal acts of violence. This has been cited as one of the reasons why so many of the most vicious sex crimes are perpetrated by marijuana users. Crimes of robbery, burglary, and homicide are also common in these cases, and the police found that individuals are usually under the influence of marijuana when a person tries his first injection of heroin. Marijuana exaggerates whatever mood a person may be in. It gives him a delusion of greatness, strength, and influence. He conceives of himself as a talented artist or an enchanting lover. He may also appear to be content or easygoing, even hysterically laughing, but he can immediately fly into a violent rage at the slightest provocation. Because of this unpredictable effect of behavior, police officers consider a person under the influence of marijuana to be dangerous. Continuous use of this drug will deteriorate the brain tissues, bring about a complete state of insanity in some cases, which requires permanent confinement to a mental institution. Here are the more obvious and readily apparent symptoms of a person under the influence of marijuana. First, visible muscular tremors. Second, accelerated pulse and heartbeat. Third, reckless and erratic operation of an automobile. Four, dizziness, resulting in an irregular walk and an unsteady stride. 5, irrational behavior, such as reckless and brazen disregard toward other people. Now, the Los Angeles Police Report indicates that when a youth or adult has become somewhat accustomed to experimenting with LSD and marijuana, there is a very likely possibility that he will try the heavy opiates. This brings him to a disastrous crisis of total drug addiction. Here is the way an 18-year-old boy named Jan from New York City evolved into heavy narcotics. He says, quote, "This will sound crazy, but after LSD, I felt I didn't exist anymore. I was nothing. I shouldn't be alive. I had no feeling of who I was. That so depressed me, I started on junk, heroin. Then I didn't feel anything, unquote. Jan became a hardened addict and soon found that he was committing serious crimes to get the money for his craving of narcotics. Heroin is probably the worst of all the alkaloids that can be manufactured from opium. It is completely impractical for medical purposes. Its manufacture has been outlawed. Heroin has all the bad features of other addictive drugs, plus the fact that it is many times stronger. It is also extremely expensive. Heroin addicts frequently reach the stage where $50 to $75 per day are required to get enough heroin just to feel normal. The cells of the body not only crave the narcotic to feed upon, but they threaten to go into convulsions if the narcotic is delayed or withheld. This is called the withdrawal symptoms, which absolutely terrifies the drug addict. It is this fear of withdrawal, as much as the craving for the drug, which drives an addict to commit crimes and get the money needed to buy more dope. Here is what withdrawal is like. As the body cells begin signaling for a fix, the addict commences yawning, accompanied by profuse sweating and running of the nose and eyes. There is marked dilation of the pupils of the eye, and severe hot flashes begin surging through the system, followed by an attack of cold chills. The muscles begin to twitch. This is a sign that the system is getting ready to go into withdrawal pains. It is this stage which terrifies the addict. The whole body commences to go into violent cramps. Addicts describe the excruciating pain as shooting from the roots of their hair down to their toenails. There is continuous nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. Life becomes a torturous nightmare and sleep is impossible. Addicts have been known to remain awake for weeks at a time, resting only in a coma. The pain is so severe during the first several days of withdrawal that the addict will throw himself to the floor, double up in convulsive cramps, and scream for relief. Unless one has seen a confirmed addict pass through this torturous experience, it is almost impossible to comprehend. One would imagine that this would permanently cure a person who has been subject to addiction. Unfortunately, it does not. The vast majority of those who have once been hooked on anything as strong as heroin will go back to it eventually, even after they are supposed to be cured. This is the real tragedy of the so-called hippies and the 13 to 15-year-old teeny boppers. They think they are just enjoying a temporary binge of drugs, sex, and psychedelic hallucinations, when they are actually launching into a pattern which, if continued, is guaranteed to turn them from healthy and wholesome human beings into half-mad creatures of a nightmare existence. When I see some of these young people in the prime of life with their straggly hair, dirty clothes, and sleazy gait, herding together like a cult of uncivilized cave dwellers, I cannot help but wonder what will happen to them further down the trail. I have seen enough of them to know what life can do to them. They may be hippies today, but tomorrow they are junkies, half-educated, broken in health, alumni of a dozen jails, objects of charity, just human derelicts. Many of them think that after their binge, they will get rid of their heroin, hallucinations, etc., and get on with life. But it is not that easy. Many of them that think they are just on a temporary binge are more hooked than they really know. Here is a note from a former hippie, which has been preserved by Bill Helper of the Long Beach Police Department. The note said, "King Heroin is my shepherd. I shall always want. He maketh me to lie down in the gutters. He leadeth me beside troubled waters. He destroyeth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of wickedness for the effort's sake. Yea, I shall walk through the valley of poverty and will fear all evil. For thou, heroin, art with me. Thy needle and capsule try to comfort me. Thou strippest the table of groceries in the presence of my family. Thou robbest my head of reason. My cup of sorrow runneth over. Surely heroin addiction shall stalk me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the damned forever." On the back of this note, the author had added a postscript. Here's what it said. "Truly this is my psalm. I am a young woman, 20 years of age, but for the past year and a half, I have been wandering down the nightmare alley of the junkies. I want to quit taking dope, and I try, but I can't. Jail didn't cure me, nor did hospitalization help me for long. The doctor told my family it would have been better and indeed kinder if the person who first got me hooked on dope had taken a gun and blown my brains out. I wish to God she had. Unquote. Well, such is the end of the hippie trail. And thousands of our young people are on that trail today. I like to think we can do something about it. I like to think the young people themselves will want to do something about it. The big job is really education. We have to somehow get the story to them in time. Preaching won't do it, but teaching might. I have faith in our young people. I'm raising 8 of them myself. Somehow I feel that if we really try, if we really concentrate on this whole narcotics fad, we can get our youth to see the futility of it and the stupidity of it. In conclusion, therefore, may I offer several possible solutions. First, may I suggest that it needs to be recognized and emphasized that the current narcotics fad is very much like a forest fire. It is self-expanding with each inflamed goofballer, psychedelic, and hippie trying to inflame and involve his friends. And like a forest fire, it is self-destroying, leaving in its wake the ugly, burned out, and disfigured fragments of what used to be promising human beings. Secondly, it is time to recognize that this forest fire of narcotic contagion can and should be contained. A bare majority of the President's Crime Commission wanted to remove the stigma of crime from narcotics and treat it like malaria or smallpox. In other words, treat it merely as a medical problem. However, a substantial minority of the commission, the ones who seem to have the most professional experience and competence in dealing with the problem, strongly disagreed. They said the medical aspects of the problem are remedial or therapeutic, but not preventive. They said the promoters and participants in the narcotic cults are conspiratorial and are waging a war against decent and orderly society. Therefore, those responsible need to be identified and penalized rather than cuddled and coddled, they said. Laws needed to be stiffened, they said, not softened. Enforcement, particularly by the courts, needed to be far more vigorous, decisive, and prompt. Furthermore, they said new laws needed to be passed facilitating the procedure for the collecting of evidence and convicting of the guilty. We once had such a procedure, but the Supreme Court, with several of its members strongly dissenting, threw it out. The Congress then passed a new law, which was hailed as a fair and restrained approach to the problem, but the President, for some reason, elected to veto it. At the moment, therefore, the legal containment of narcotics is deplorably weak, and the minority members of the President's Crime Commission have discovered a serious prevention gap in the narcotics front, which I feel needs immediate repair. Third, there needs to be a widespread educational program designed to give narcotics a cultural taboo. The laws I just mentioned are needed primarily to contain the small rebel element, which prides itself in creating chaos in our society. But the majority of the people will respond to an educational and cultural approach. The strength in this approach was demonstrated in England. As long as the English had cultural contempt for narcotics addiction, the problem was amazingly well contained. Even their laws could be permissive so long as the cultural taboo was exceptionally strong. But today there is growing alarm in England because the cultural breakdown has struck there just as it has here. Their permissive laws have also allowed the same prevention gap to develop there as we have developed here. They are therefore considering a much stronger legal defense as well as a new drive to educate the people. And we need that here. Fourth, if we are to develop an effective program of education on narcotics, it must be initiated and maintained on the institutional level where the attitudes and cultural values of our youth are being formed. Initially, this is in the home, but ultimately, it is in the school. As a rule, the elementary and secondary schools have done a fairly effective job, but a devastating breakdown has occurred on the college and university level. Both parents who pay the taxes and students who have come for an education deserve a better climate of order and common sense than has existed on so many campuses where riots, pornography, narcotics, and venal sexuality have been allowed to develop into an established pattern of campus life. I believe parents and students both deserve something better than that. Fifth, it needs to be recognized that the creation of fads in human behavior is exactly like the creation of fads in dresses and bathing suits. People like to be in on the latest thing. Therefore, whatever the newspapers, magazines, radio, and TV start booming as the latest grooviest thing is going to catch on. What I'm trying to say here is that the mass communications media could perform a tremendous public service by developing a code of ethics which says they will not give expensive page space and airtime to stories which will obviously promote a fascinating interest in human depravity and narcotic debauchery. What I'm asking for is not censorship, but an emphasis on honest reality. It makes a tremendous impact on a young mind if narcotics are presented as the latest, grooviest thing, something the smart set is all doing. It would be just as easy to portray the goofballer, acid head, and pot smoker as an archaic form of stupidity, which modern civilization has repudiated as completely as human sacrifices. And finally, let me say just a word about the home. This is always the favorite scapegoat to blame for most of our problems. But the fact remains that the home is indeed the key to a civilization's survival. Therefore, we turn to the home in hoping it will help meet the escalating problem of narcotics. Here are several things for parents to remember. First of all, young people who are practicing a consistent participation in genuine religious activity, not the God is dead cult, but genuine religious activity, will hardly ever fall for the lure of narcotics. All of our studies prove this. Secondly, young people who have a wholesome group of associates around them with a cultural taboo against narcotics have no difficulty avoiding the current fad. Third, young people and even adults who do get involved in the psychedelic or addiction fad are usually those who are bored with life, who don't have enough challenge, who don't have enough responsibility or enough opportunity to be creatively involved in life. Here are some of the things every home can take decisive action in doing something about right now. Furthermore, young people, also adults who find themselves bored and neutralized toward life, I believe have a responsibility to get with it and not wait for somebody else to coddle, cajole, or cudgel them into becoming happy, creative human beings. So, my message is not one of despair. There is plenty all of us can do about this current problem of psychedelics, hallucinations, and addiction. Certainly the challenge is sufficiently acute to demand the best from each of us.